Cambridge International Examinations, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, March Examination Series 2017, English as a Second Language. Extended Tier, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear four short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than three words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. How will the class travel to their destination? B. What are the students going to do on their trip?
Have you got everything for tomorrow's trip to Edinburgh?
Yes, Mum. Don't worry.
What time do you need to set off in the morning?
Around 7, I think.
Are you walking to school?
Well, I'm going to take the bus to meet up with Martin. Everybody needs to be at the station by 8:15 because our art teacher, Mrs. Achal, has to check that we've all turned up. We're catching the 8:30 direct train to Edinburgh.
Oh, are you going to the castle there?
We did that last time and also did a lot of walking. This time we've got to take photos. Mrs. Achal is thinking of putting together a display for the parents' evening.
Have you got everything for tomorrow's trip to Edinburgh?
Yes, Mum. Don't worry.
What time do you need to set off in the morning?
Around 7, I think.
Are you walking to school?
Well, I'm going to take the bus to meet up with Martin. Everybody needs to be at the station by 8:15 because our art teacher, Mrs. Achal, has to check that we've all turned up. We're catching the 8:30 direct train to Edinburgh.
Oh, are you going to the castle there?
We did that last time and also did a lot of walking. This time we've got to take photos. Mrs. Achal is thinking of putting together a display for the parents' evening.
Question 2. A. Which part of the country will have the wettest weather today? B. When will the weather become more settled?
As you can see from the satellite images, the southeast is the most affected by the strong winds we've been experiencing since Sunday. These will be accompanied by some heavy showers. The north will see some brighter spells during the day, with temperatures reaching double figures in the afternoon. On Wednesday, the west coast will enjoy much more stable conditions as warm weather arrives, which will be with us for the rest of the week. Looking ahead, from Monday onwards, things are set to change. As you can see from the satellite images, the southeast is the most affected by the strong winds we've been experiencing since Sunday. These will be accompanied by some heavy showers. The north will see some brighter spells during the day, with temperatures reaching double figures in the afternoon. On Wednesday, the west coast will enjoy much more stable conditions as warm weather arrives, which will be with us for the rest of the week. Looking ahead, from Monday onwards, things are set to change.
Question 3. A. What does the girl like best about the new sports centre? B. How much will the boy have to pay for his monthly membership fee?
Have you been to the new sports centre yet?
No, have you?
Yes, I went swimming there last night and watched the sunset through their huge glass windows. It was so relaxing, though nothing beats their diving pool.
I've also heard that they're offering boxing classes.
Yes, I think they're very popular.
Are you a member? Is it expensive?
I pay £2.50 each time I go swimming, but I'm not a member. I know there are different options if you want to join. It's £48.50 per month, but as you're a student, you're eligible for a discount, which brings it down to £21.50.
I thought it'd be around £60.
Have you been to the new sports centre yet?
No, have you?
Yes, I went swimming there last night and watched the sunset through their huge glass windows. It was so relaxing, though nothing beats their diving pool.
I've also heard that they're offering boxing classes.
Yes, I think they're very popular.
Are you a member? Is it expensive?
I pay £2.50 each time I go swimming, but I'm not a member. I know there are different options if you want to join. It's £48.50 per month, but as you're a student, you're eligible for a discount, which brings it down to £21.50.
I thought it'd be around £60.
Question 4. A. What will the prize be for the winner of the fashion show? B. Where can students get essential information about the next fashion show?
Following the success of last year's end-of-year fashion show, which helped our students with their university applications to study fashion and design, we've now decided to make it an annual event. This year, the winner will be offered work experience with a local business owner involved in the fashion industry. We'd like you to experiment with turning something old into something new. For example, recycling an item of clothing to make something trendy that you'd be happy to wear. The school library has some photos from last year's event, but if you'd like to enter, go to the school website for the application form and the rules. Following the success of last year's end-of-year fashion show, which helped our students with their university applications to study fashion and design, we've now decided to make it an annual event. This year, the winner will be offered work experience with a local business owner involved in the fashion industry. We'd like you to experiment with turning something old into something new. For example, recycling an item of clothing to make something trendy that you'd be happy to wear. The school library has some photos from last year's event, but if you'd like to enter, go to the school website for the application form and the rules.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by Ron Beckett about a competition called the Survival Challenge. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Alaska is a stunning part of the world with breathtaking views and a varied landscape, but despite its beauty, it is also known for its harsh conditions. For this reason, organisers chose this state for their new competition called the Survival Challenge. Moreover, Alaska is also home to 17 of the 20 highest peaks in the United States, and this reality show certainly tests contestants' physical endurance and survival skills. The competition is done in teams for safety reasons and to test teamwork. The goal of the competition is for contestants to get from the starting point to the finish in a given time. This year, the starting point was an island with a high population of bears. The contestants didn't have to worry about creatures like snakes or spiders, but had to be ready to deal with other dangers later on, like mountain river crossings, in order to get to the finishing line, which was near a 1,200-metre-high active volcano. The organisers always take the contestants' safety very seriously. In case of emergencies, a helicopter was available 24 hours a day at the nearest hospital, and each team was also equipped with a two-way radio. Teams were only given basic supplies at the start and had to provide more food for themselves on the way. Some tried surviving by picking berries and collecting wild mushrooms, but soon realised that, although it was much more difficult, it was fish that was going to give them the necessary energy, if only they could catch them. Having enough safe water to drink was another challenge. The rivers and ice from glaciers provided plenty of water, which contestants were advised to purify before drinking. Organisers also made sure that all contestants had a complete supply of salt tablets to take on a regular basis. This helped all contestants to keep well hydrated and stay healthy throughout the competition. Alaska can get extremely cold, as almost a third of the state lies within the Arctic Circle. The highest average temperature is around 17 degrees Celsius in June. In a cold year, the highest average temperature in the same month can be as low as 8 degrees. Between July and May, it is even less warm, with August and September seeing the highest rainfall. In snow-covered areas, some preparation was needed before the tent could be put up for the night. For contestants, staying warm when sleeping was rather tricky. Even with a good sleeping bag inside the tent, it was vital that all the snow had been cleared away in order to benefit from the ground, which provided insulation. Despite contestants initially worrying about having cold hands and feet, all teams had been instructed to focus on protecting their necks when the temperature dropped, as most heat is lost through that part of the body. Having said that, people shouldn't wear too many layers of clothing in general, because we also lose heat through sweat. For this reason, the contestants were all provided with clothes made from a light material which was both breathable and waterproof. Now, before I talk about the winning team, are there any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
Alaska is a stunning part of the world with breathtaking views and a varied landscape, but despite its beauty, it is also known for its harsh conditions. For this reason, organisers chose this state for their new competition called the Survival Challenge. Moreover, Alaska is also home to 17 of the 20 highest peaks in the United States. And this reality show certainly tests contestants' physical endurance and survival skills. The competition is done in teams for safety reasons and to test teamwork. The goal of the competition is for contestants to get from the starting point to the finish in a given time. This year, the starting point was an island with a high population of bears. The contestants didn't have to worry about creatures like snakes or spiders, but had to be ready to deal with other dangers later on, like mountain river crossings, in order to get to the finishing line, which was near a 1,200-metre-high active volcano. The organisers always take the contestants' safety very seriously. In case of emergencies, a helicopter was available 24 hours a day at the nearest hospital, and each team was also equipped with a two-way radio. Teams were only given basic supplies at the start and had to provide more food for themselves on the way. Some tried surviving by picking berries and collecting wild mushrooms, but soon realised that, although it was much more difficult, it was fish that was going to give them the necessary energy, if only they could catch them. Having enough safe water to drink was another challenge. The rivers and ice from glaciers provided plenty of water, which contestants were advised to purify before drinking. Organisers also made sure that all contestants had a complete supply of salt tablets to take on a regular basis. This helped all contestants to keep well hydrated and stay healthy throughout the competition. Alaska can get extremely cold, as almost a third of the state lies within the Arctic Circle. The highest average temperature is around 17 degrees Celsius in June. In a cold year, the highest average temperature in the same month can be as low as 8 degrees. Between July and May, it is even less warm, with August and September seeing the highest rainfall. In snow-covered areas, some preparation was needed before the tent could be put up for the night. For contestants, staying warm when sleeping was rather tricky. Even with a good sleeping bag inside the tent, it was vital that all the snow had been cleared away in order to benefit from the ground, which provided insulation. Despite contestants initially worrying about having cold hands and feet, all teams had been instructed to focus on protecting their necks when the temperature dropped, as most heat is lost through that part of the body. Having said that, people shouldn't wear too many layers of clothing in general, because we also lose heat through sweat. For this reason, the contestants were all provided with clothes made from a light material, which was both breathable and waterproof. Now, before I talk about the winning team, are there any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about public transport. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recording twice. Speaker 1.
As a student, I must watch my travel budget. I don't live very near school, so I can't walk or cycle and rely heavily on buses. That's why I really appreciate the fact that I can buy a season ticket, which is valid for the whole year and works out cheaper. Weekend tickets are also good value for money. They're valid on both buses and local trains. When my friends come to visit, they often buy a day travel card, so that we don't waste money on taxis, which is great.
Speaker 2.
I don't drive, so I depend on public transport. Compared to other colleagues who don't have much choice, there are enough bus stops near to where I live. But the main problem is the heavy traffic, which makes the journey to the city centre very stressful. So many people insist on driving to work, which adds to traffic jams, and this means I'm often late. I really think the City Council should promote public transport a bit more so that people give up their cars on weekdays in favour of buses.
Speaker 3.
I have a car which I couldn't live without, and I use it a lot at the weekend. But on weekdays, I always take the train to work. I often hear complaints about the increasing cost of tickets, and to be fair, they're getting a bit pricey. But for me, it's still good value for money. In the morning, I can have my cup of coffee on the train. On the way back, I get some work done, or I can catch up with my emails, things I couldn't do if I was driving.
Speaker 4.
I rely on public transport a lot these days. I recently had to give up driving my car to work because of the rising cost of petrol. At first, I was anxious about commuting by bus. I heard a lot of complaints about public transport in rural areas not being reliable. But so far, I've had no experience of buses arriving late or not turning up at all. The only thing I can't stand is the litter in some buses that you see later in the day.
Speaker 5.
My grandmother lives in a village not far from the city. She's a very active lady and likes to visit her friends in the city every week. When she travels during the week, she just about manages to get where she wants to go. The weekend is a different story, though. She often phones me to ask if I could give her a lift because the scheduled bus didn't turn up. I think it's unfair that services in some rural parts are so poor, especially considering that everyone is being asked to use public transport more often.
Speaker 6.
Young people like to go out at the weekend, and I'm no exception. I often take the bus to the city centre to meet friends. We then decide if we want to go out for a meal or to the cinema. Unfortunately, cinema tickets are not cheap. But we recently discovered that if we go to the city centre by bus, we can get a 30% reduction on films in certain cinemas. The only downside is that with late movies, we often miss the last bus and have to take a taxi back home because there's no service.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
As a student, I must watch my travel budget. I don't live very near school, so I can't walk or cycle and rely heavily on buses. That's why I really appreciate the fact that I can buy a season ticket, which is valid for the whole year and works out cheaper. Weekend tickets are also good value for money. They're valid on both buses and local trains. When my friends come to visit, they often buy a day travel card so that we don't waste money on taxis, which is great.
Speaker 2.
I don't drive, so I depend on public transport. Compared to other colleagues who don't have much choice, there are enough bus stops near to where I live. But the main problem is the heavy traffic, which makes the journey to the city centre very stressful. So many people insist on driving to work, which adds to traffic jams, and this means I'm often late. I really think the City Council should promote public transport a bit more so that people give up their cars on weekdays in favour of buses.
Speaker 3.
I have a car which I couldn't live without, and I use it a lot at the weekend. But on weekdays, I always take the train to work. I often hear complaints about the increasing cost of tickets, and to be fair, they're getting a bit pricey. But for me, it's still good value for money. In the morning, I can have my cup of coffee on the train. On the way back, I get some work done, or I can catch up with my emails, things I couldn't do if I was driving.
Speaker 4.
I rely on public transport a lot these days. I recently had to give up driving my car to work because of the rising cost of petrol. At first, I was anxious about commuting by bus. I heard a lot of complaints about public transport in rural areas not being reliable. But so far, I've had no experience of buses arriving late or not turning up at all. The only thing I can't stand is the litter in some buses that you see later in the day.
Speaker 5.
My grandmother lives in a village not far from the city. She's a very active lady and likes to visit her friends in the city every week. When she travels during the week, she just about manages to get where she wants to go. The weekend is a different story, though. She often phones me to ask if I could give her a lift because the scheduled bus didn't turn up. I think it's unfair that services in some rural parts are so poor, especially considering that everyone is being asked to use public transport more often.
Speaker 6.
Young people like to go out at the weekend, and I'm no exception. I often take the bus to the city centre to meet friends. We then decide if we want to go out for a meal or to the cinema. Unfortunately, cinema tickets are not cheap. But we recently discovered that if we go to the city centre by bus, we can get a 30% reduction on films in certain cinemas. The only downside is that with late movies, we often miss the last bus and have to take a taxi back home because there's no service.
That is the end of the short talks about public transport. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear a journalist talking to Teresa Rivera, who is a Mexican pianist. Listen to their conversation and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the conversation twice.
Teresa, I know you started very young, but what attracted you to classical music at such an early age?
Well, many musicians would tell you it was a parent that inspired them. And don't get me wrong, my dad encouraged me too, later on. But I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for the woman who lived next door. She was crazy about Mozart and first introduced me to the magical world of classical music. My teacher at school just had to build on what she'd started.
And what about your choice of instrument?
Many people think that musicians go for the piano because of the many different styles and pieces that have been written for it. What really appealed to me as a child was that when I heard different songs on the radio, I could pick out the notes so easily on the piano. It was very much later that I could choose music that matched my own moods.
I know you were a dedicated student, but did you ever regret your decision?
You mean the fact I devoted all my time to learning the piano? No, never. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't hard, especially at the College of Music. And I was suddenly surrounded by all these talented musicians. Most of my friends from home didn't understand my commitment, and we drifted apart, which made me quite sad. The toughest part for me as a student, though, was my parents' expectations.
It happens to a lot of talented children, doesn't it? That brings me to your life in Austria.
Yes, my father was a diplomat, and for most of my youth we lived there. But when he was sent back to Mexico, I was faced with an important decision. I was 20 and decided to stay on. It wasn't such a hard choice, since I'd just been offered a place to study with a well-known pianist. I didn't realise it then, but looking back, staying away from my parents gave me time to work out the kind of artist I wanted to be, but I still missed them very much.
Now, we have to talk about your piano collection. You've got 5, I believe?
Only 4, actually. I think of them as more than just a collection because they've been with me through happy and also sad times, just like companions. One of them has been with me for most of my life. The most recent one, though, was a gift from my record company, and I call it the Youngster. It's a modern piano which is ideal for some classical pieces, but not for others. I think the wood needs to mature a bit.
And tell me, how does it feel being on stage?
As a young artist, you get anxious before going on stage. And even now, as a mature artist, I haven't been able to overcome this. The audience is always supportive, though, and I've never had a bad reception, which really helps. When it comes to recording in a studio, I can always stop and start if I'm not happy with my playing.
Well, your music always sounds perfect to me. And what would you say was your proudest moment?
In my career, I've been lucky enough to play with great orchestras. I'm also grateful to all those people who like my music and voted for me last year in the International Piano Competition, which meant getting first prize. The highlight of my career to date was when my manager rang to tell me I'd been signed up by a well-known music label.
So, what do you think the future holds for classical music?
There are lots of talented young musicians out there who continually inspire young people to get interested in classical music. I've seen the result of this in many schools, where the piano seems to be a popular choice. I'm not worried about the future of classical music. I only wish there were more generous funds to help out promising artists.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you, Teresa.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Teresa, I know you started very young, but what attracted you to classical music at such an early age?
Well, many musicians would tell you it was a parent that inspired them. And don't get me wrong, my dad encouraged me too, later on. But I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for the woman who lived next door. She was crazy about Mozart and first introduced me to the magical world of classical music. My teacher at school just had to build on what she'd started.
And what about your choice of instrument?
Many people think that musicians go for the piano because of the many different styles and pieces that have been written for it. What really appealed to me as a child was that when I heard different songs on the radio, I could pick out the notes so easily on the piano. It was very much later that I could choose music that matched my own moods.
I know you were a dedicated student, but did you ever regret your decision?
You mean the fact I devoted all my time to learning the piano? No, never. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't hard, especially at the College of Music. And I was suddenly surrounded by all these talented musicians. Most of my friends from home didn't understand my commitment, and we drifted apart, which made me quite sad. The toughest part for me as a student, though, was my parents' expectations.
It happens to a lot of talented children, doesn't it? That brings me to your life in Austria.
Yes, my father was a diplomat, and for most of my youth we lived there. But when he was sent back to Mexico, I was faced with an important decision. I was 20 and decided to stay on. It wasn't such a hard choice, since I'd just been offered a place to study with a well-known pianist. I didn't realise it then, but looking back, staying away from my parents gave me time to work out the kind of artist I wanted to be, but I still missed them very much.
Now, we have to talk about your piano collection. You've got 5, I believe?
Only 4, actually. I think of them as more than just a collection because they've been with me through happy and also sad times, just like companions. One of them has been with me for most of my life. The most recent one, though, was a gift from my record company, and I call it the Youngster. It's a modern piano which is ideal for some classical pieces, but not for others. I think the wood needs to mature a bit.
And tell me, how does it feel being on stage?
As a young artist, you get anxious before going on stage. And even now, as a mature artist, I haven't been able to overcome this. The audience is always supportive, though, and I've never had a bad reception, which really helps. When it comes to recording in a studio, I can always stop and start if I'm not happy with my playing.
Well, your music always sounds perfect to me. And what would you say was your proudest moment?
In my career, I've been lucky enough to play with great orchestras. I'm also grateful to all those people who like my music and voted for me last year in the International Piano Competition, which meant getting first prize. The highlight of my career to date was when my manager rang to tell me I'd been signed up by a well-known music label.
So, what do you think the future holds for classical music?
There are lots of talented young musicians out there who continually inspire young people to get interested in classical music. I've seen the result of this in many schools, where the piano seems to be a popular choice. I'm not worried about the future of classical music. I only wish there were more generous funds to help out promising artists.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you, Teresa.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part A. You will hear an expert giving a talk about what lies beneath the city of Rome. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words, or a number, in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about my latest expedition to Rome, where my team and I explored the unknown, mysterious spaces beneath this ancient city. For many years, Rome has been experiencing sudden collapses of land which have created large holes. When I first heard about these incidents, the number stood at 44 holes a year, which almost doubled 2 years later during our expedition and reached 83 and is still growing. Since we left, around 114 holes have been reported. These holes normally occur naturally as a result of an underground space created by water. As this space grows, the surface above it cannot support its own weight and collapses. In Rome, the holes appear because of human activity, which was why we were interested in them. The first hole we inspected revealed an ancient quarry stretching for miles below the surface. To get the exact size, we used the latest lasers to scan the area and create a 3D image, something we repeated each time we discovered a new quarry. The result of our efforts was a map of 90 underground quarries and their extent, which will be invaluable for local authorities and their future development plans. Ancient Romans were keen builders and required a vast supply of building material to satisfy the needs of a growing city, and the quarries are the result of this. Rome lies on volcanic rocks, which were the initial materials sourced from quarries around the city for the construction of palaces, bridges, and protective walls. Later, Romans went on to discover other stones, such as marble, but this particular stone wasn't mined locally. Apart from the usual blocks of stone, brick, which may seem like an unsuitable building material for that time, was readily used by Roman builders. Concrete was another important construction material that was used to build some of Rome's most magnificent architecture, a fact that some members of the team were surprised to learn when we met with a local geologist. At the end of our expedition, we came across a quarry with an ancient exit through which the miners would take out the rocks. It was boarded up, but we were curious to see where the exit would take us to. We suspected some outdoor space like a road or a private garden. We'd never imagined it was going to be a cellar. So today, tourists in Rome might be walking above ancient underground spaces without even realizing what lies beneath their feet. Now, let's look at some photos.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about my latest expedition to Rome, where my team and I explored the unknown, mysterious spaces beneath this ancient city. For many years, Rome has been experiencing sudden collapses of land which have created large holes. When I first heard about these incidents, the number stood at 44 holes a year, which almost doubled 2 years later during our expedition, and reached 83 and is still growing. Since we left, around 114 holes have been reported. These holes normally occur naturally as a result of an underground space created by water. As this space grows, the surface above it cannot support its own weight and collapses. In Rome, the holes appear because of human activity, which was why we were interested in them. The first hole we inspected revealed an ancient quarry stretching for miles below the surface. To get the exact size, we used the latest lasers to scan the area and create a 3D image, something we repeated each time we discovered a new quarry. The result of our efforts was a map of 90 underground quarries and their extent, which will be invaluable for local authorities and their future development plans. Ancient Romans were keen builders and required a vast supply of building material to satisfy the needs of a growing city, and the quarries are the result of this. Rome lies on volcanic rocks, which were the initial materials sourced from quarries around the city for the construction of palaces, bridges, and protective walls. Later, Romans went on to discover other stones, such as marble, but this particular stone wasn't mined locally. Apart from the usual blocks of stone, brick, which may seem like an unsuitable building material for that time, was readily used by Roman builders. Concrete was another important construction material that was used to build some of Rome's most magnificent architecture, a fact that some members of the team were surprised to learn when we met with a local geologist. At the end of our expedition, we came across a quarry with an ancient exit through which the miners would take out the rocks. It was boarded up, but we were curious to see where the exit would take us to. We suspected some outdoor space like a road or a private garden. We'd never imagined it was going to be a cellar. So today, tourists in Rome might be walking above ancient underground spaces without even realizing what lies beneath their feet. Now, let's look at some photos.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment you will hear question 8, part B. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about an aqueduct, a structure like a canal for carrying water, and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hi, Makiko. Is everything all right? I noticed you left the talk early yesterday.
Yeah, I had an appointment. Shame, really, because I was enjoying the talk and wanted to hear more about the aqueducts.
Well, the speaker talked mostly about one of them. I can't remember its exact name, but it was an underground one, not far from a famous tourist spot.
And how did they get to it? Through another tunnel?
Well, that's what I thought at first. The archaeologists who were originally working on this site used wooden ladders, which were only temporary, to get down to the aqueduct. And then, during their excavations, they found the stone steps that the Romans had built, which go down more than 20 metres below the surface.
Oh, right. I'd love to go down there. I'm only familiar with aqueducts above ground. The Romans built a lot of these because they used a huge amount of water in general. It was an essential source for their public baths, which were very important because men gathered there to do business. The water from these aqueducts also supplied impressive fountains, which acted as a focal point for the community and were more popular than gardens at that time.
Wow, the Romans really loved their water.
Yes, you could say that. But tell me more about this underground aqueduct.
Well, apparently, ancient Romans often described the water as pleasant to drink, but some people complained it was too cold. Before the talk, I had assumed the water would have been polluted, but because it was channeled underground as it flowed down from the hills, it was safe to drink.
I guess this aqueduct is still functional and it's survived to this day almost untouched because it's protected for most of its journey. But many of the other aqueducts above ground got damaged.
You mean they deteriorated because of effects of the weather, like storms and winds?
Yes, that played a part, and sometimes leaks had to be fixed. But actually, the most severe destruction was often put down to enemy tribes who wanted to cut off Rome's water supply and disrupt the life of the city. This was towards the end of the Roman Empire when it had started to decline. The rest of the damage was caused by the lack of maintenance. But luckily, the aqueducts were renovated by engineers and architects in the 15th century.
And did you know, while they were excavating in the 15th century, they found a lot of interesting items, some of which you can still see in museums today. For example, I saw some coins stamped with the heads of important Roman generals. I've seen loads of those before. What was unexpected were bits of tiles with writing on them, which people made especially for personal reasons. There was also a lot of silver jewellery, most of it broken, but one or two rings that you could wear today.
You know what? I'm going to write about this.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Hi, Makiko. Is everything all right? I noticed you left the talk early yesterday.
Yeah, I had an appointment. Shame, really, because I was enjoying the talk and wanted to hear more about the aqueducts.
Well, the speaker talked mostly about one of them. I can't remember its exact name, but it was an underground one, not far from a famous tourist spot.
And how did they get to it? Through another tunnel?
Well, that's what I thought at first. The archaeologists who were originally working on this site used wooden ladders, which were only temporary, to get down to the aqueduct. And then, during their excavations, they found the stone steps that the Romans had built, which go down more than 20 metres below the surface.
Oh, right. I'd love to go down there. I'm only familiar with aqueducts above ground. The Romans built a lot of these because they used a huge amount of water in general. It was an essential source for their public baths, which were very important because men gathered there to do business. The water from these aqueducts also supplied impressive fountains, which acted as a focal point for the community and were more popular than gardens at that time.
Wow, the Romans really loved their water.
Yes, you could say that. But tell me more about this underground aqueduct.
Well, apparently, ancient Romans often described the water as pleasant to drink, but some people complained it was too cold. Before the talk, I had assumed the water would have been polluted, but because it was channeled underground as it flowed down from the hills, it was safe to drink.
I guess this aqueduct is still functional and it's survived to this day almost untouched because it's protected for most of its journey. But many of the other aqueducts above ground got damaged.
You mean they deteriorated because of effects of the weather, like storms and winds?
Yes, that played a part, and sometimes leaks had to be fixed. But actually the most severe destruction was often put down to enemy tribes who wanted to cut off Rome's water supply and disrupt the life of the city. This was towards the end of the Roman Empire when it had started to decline. The rest of the damage was caused by the lack of maintenance, but luckily the aqueducts were renovated by engineers and architects in the 15th century.
And did you know, while they were excavating in the 15th century, they found a lot of interesting items, some of which you can still see in museums today. For example, I saw some coins stamped with the heads of important Roman generals. I've seen loads of those before. What was unexpected were bits of tiles with writing on them, which people made especially for personal reasons. There was also a lot of silver jewellery, most of it broken, but one or two rings that you could wear today.
You know what? I'm going to write about this.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.